Wherever you have come from, whoever you are, whoever you love, whatever your journey has been, it has led you here, and we are glad to have you. In order to fully welcome everyone into this space, I invite those of you already seated and able to move forward or closer together to leave room for those who continue to arrive as we have gathered. And then while you're up and stretching, go ahead and greet your neighbor.
Just glance back every now and again.
Thank you.
Now it's time in our order of service for joys and sorrows. If you have a brief personal joy or sorrow to share, please raise your hand and the microphone will be brought down to you.
I'm Tate Pelletier. My sister's son was in a very bad motor cycle accident yesterday. He was going 75 miles per hour and had a blowout. And he lives in New Mexico. He had multiple injuries, and as you can imagine, and he's in ICU. And my sister is already dealing with her husband having metastatic stomach cancer. So this is really tough. So please keep them in your thoughts and prayers.
Lady Hoprock with the welcoming committee, and we have a joy this morning. We have a new member, Michelle Gormley.
My joy is today, of course, being Valentine's Day. It's the 37th year that Kent and Beth had their first date. They will celebrate, of course, the 37th anniversary in December. But they have, of course, one return to Kansas. I don't know why, the way things are right now. But they will one return to Kansas when they retire. And over the holidays, New Year's, Christmas and New Year's, they settled on a little cottage in Florence. So we have been slowly trying to help them furnish it. I'm getting them my dining room set and bookcases and things. So. But the joy is that they are between Alexandria, Virginia and Florence, Kansas now, once a month at least. And they'll just be closer. We'll have the joy of their closer to the grandkids. But today is a joyous day of love.
For those joys or sorrows left unspoken, we hold you in our hearts. We'll have the anthem next, led by director Michael Oldfather, and the new one of the singers. I gave my love a cheer. out there, so face towards me. I know in public speaking you're not supposed to have your back to the audience, but my audience is you guys. How are we doing today? Good. Happy Valentine's Day. So today our vision statement is guiding our order of service, and one thing that we want to do here at UUFM is be an incubator for the next generation of UUs. So hold up your hand if you can tell me what an incubator is. You always have the good answers. Very good. Anybody else have any other thoughts on what an incubator is or what it does? So it kind of is a mothering thing, right? Keeps you warm, keeps you safe, helps you grow. How about the rest of this? We are fostering spiritual and ethical exploration. Somebody else, tell me what exploration is. Yes, right over here. He forgot. What do you do if you go outside and you explore?
Wander.
I like that. I feel like a lot of you use wander. I did. Still do.
You look around and try to take notes again.
Looking around, taking notes. She's going to be a really good student in school. So we also tailor that exploration to age and stage to promote intergenerational unity. So we say generations, that means all of you children and all of these big kids out here. What is something that you like about this church, this fellowship?
It's very welcoming and everybody is happy to have a place here.
I think that one deserves an applause. Somebody else, what do you like about this fellowship?
It's fun.
It's fun.
Okay. Now, since it's Valentine's Day, I'm going to ask you a silly question. It's okay if you're a little shy. But who do you love? Is there somebody out there that you love?
Mom.
His mom. All right. If any of your parents are out there, I would like you to stand if you could.
Everybody.
We're all family. Parents out there, go ahead and stand up. Quick exercise. Stretch your legs. Come on. All right. My next question to this group of people is, would you please stand if you love these children up here? Look at that. That is a whole community of love. Okay, you can sit down. Unless you're really. Well, I'll let you stay seated. Before we sing you out, we have some stickers, little heart-shaped stickers for Valentine's Day today. They're rainbow colored. How did I look upon that? And I want you to think about the words that we sing when we leave. Go in love. Our hearts go with you. Go in joy. Our hopes go too. And Michael always says the first word.
Go in love. Our hearts go with you. Go in joy. Our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow.
Personal reflection.
Do I say the mean thing I just thought of? It's a do I forgive? Do I judge? Those are good questions for all of us. And the young persons, Ari, we rely heavily on our seven principles. We know them, even if they're in the children's version. I challenge each of you to know which principle is most important to you, which one you role model well, and which one is your struggle. You do not need to be a perfect UU, but the UU should be a platform for your growth. The UUFM should be your incubator. Cliche or whole truth, it takes a village. It takes a village to raise a child, and it takes Ubuntu to make us whole. For those of you that haven't heard that before, Ubuntu is the South African concept of humanity, that I am only me because we are we. In isolation, I'm not the same being in any way, shape, or form. It's a shared humanity that's required to be human at all. We define and sustain each other. We create each other's dignity through our caring. Thank you all very much for letting me share some of my thoughts today, being inspired by working with young people, and thank you for standing up and saying that you love them.
All right, she's going to dash off to those young, inspiring ones. Next up, we'll have Helping Hands, the Peggy Bowman Second Chance Fund. Buddy Banner is here to represent their organization. We'll share a little bit of information with you, and then we'll have our offertory. The money is given to the offertory. Unless they're not specified for UU, they will go to the Peggy Bowman Second Chance Fund. So, Buddy.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The Peggy Bowman Second Chance Fund's mission is to assist Kansas women who are in need of financial support to obtain abortion services. The women we serve have found themselves pregnant and found that in their life, the termination of pregnancy is best for them. In the last 5 years, this fund, all volunteer operators with no staff, assisted over 2,193 Kansas women. UUFM has been a great supporter of this fund for a long time, and we really appreciate that. And sometimes when we've come before you, we've talked about the demographics of the women that we've served. But this time, I think we need to talk about something a little bit different. What are some of the challenges that are faced? People say, well, how much does an abortion cost? Well, that's kind of indeterminate. Number one, it depends on the status of pregnancy. How far along is this pregnancy? What are the health conditions of the mother? Is she a young adolescent? Is she a 40-year-old woman? Does she have other health concerns that need to be addressed in doing the procedure? So there's no fixed amount, but there are challenges that we are aware of that low-income women face, that middle-income women like us do not face. There was a study done in Wisconsin a year ago that looked at exactly this issue, and they found that the cost of an abortion for a low-income woman was more than twice what it costs a low-income woman because of these challenges. And I don't think Wisconsin is any different from Kansas, except for two things. Wisconsin has four abortion clinics, we have three. And in my own personal opinion, Wisconsin is a lot less rural than Kansas, particularly the Western Maine. So what do our women deal with? First off, access to medical care. Medicaid does not cover abortion services. And some of you may not know that in some states it does. The states have chosen to cover those services. Secondly, even if a person had insurance, Kansas law specifically prohibits an insurance company from offering abortion services as a part of a package unless the woman purchases an additional rider. So, all of the services are out of pocket. Secondly, lost wages. If you're like us, you probably have a job with benefits, sick time, personal time off, whatever you call it. The average housekeeper here in Manhattan who works at one of our local hotels earns $9 an hour. She typically works 25 to 30 hours a week in a good week when we have a lot of sporting events or people coming into town. So at her 30 hours a week and 4.3 number of weeks in a month, her monthly gross can be expected to be $1,161. If we subtract 15% for Social Security and other mandatory deductions, we can guess that her big take-home pay, or her net, would be about $986. So, if she wants to go and have services, first off, Kansas law requires that she have counseling 24 hours before the procedure is completed. Therefore, that means she has to travel either to Wichita or to Kansas City and endure at least one overnight stay. If she lives out in western Kansas, it might be longer because she might have to drive a day in, stay, then stay again, and maybe another day after that. Even at Super 8 prices or some of the lower motel prices, that's a lot of money out of that $900. And I would remind you that folks that work in restaurant service or fast food are not likely to even earn that much. Some of the restaurant rates are $2.15 an hour plus tips. It's appalling. If this woman has two jobs to make her living, then she has to coordinate time on her day jobs, a much more complicated thing. And you know what else? Because she doesn't have sick time and any other benefits, she has to ask her boss for time off or her supervisor. Now, what do you tell your supervisor at that point in violation or the loss of your own personal privacy in terms of seeking assistance? Transportation. 99% of the communities in Kansas do not have a clinic that can serve her. In many cases, long distances have to be traveled. We all know that public transportation is essentially unavailable. Low-income folks are lucky to have a car, and that car may not get very good gas mileage, not be very reliable, or just not quite what she needs to travel to Kansas City or Wichita. Maybe she has to ask a friend to borrow a car. Well, you know, if you want to borrow somebody's car for 2 or 3 days to leave the city, what do you tell her? Again, it's an issue and a cost. Also, if her pregnancy has gone beyond what Kansas law permits, she might need to travel to Colorado or New Mexico, states that offer greater term abortion. And I will say that our fund has made it clear to out-of-state clinics that serve Kansas women that they should contact us, and in fact do. So we have only 2-3 clinics here. We have outreach to several other states. So this woman is experiencing a lot of costs. If she already has a child, she may have to ask somebody to watch her child for 2 or 3 days. And even if her friend can do it, there's some cost involved in that. So all of this means that the cost of the procedure, plus the expenses that she incurs, means that to terminate a pregnancy for a low-income woman in this state may cost more than her monthly take-home pay. And the cost of the procedure may escalate
instruction is not to stamp our minds upon the young, but to stir up their own. Not to make them see with our eyes, but to look inquiringly and steadily with their own. Not to give them a definite amount of knowledge, but to inspire a fervent love of truth. Not to form an outward regularity, but to touch inward springs. Not to bind them by ineradicable prejudices to our particular sect of peculiar notions, but to prepare them for impartial, conscientious judging of whatever subjects may be offered to their decision. Not to burden the memory, but to quicken and strengthen the power of thought. Not to impose religion upon them in the form of arbitrary rules, but to awaken the conscience, the moral discernment. In a word, or a few, the great end is to awaken the soul to excite and cherish spiritual life. Our next hymn is number 325, Love Makes a Bridge. Please stand in body or spirit.
Incubators create conditions for growth and thriving. said, this is the second in this series of services about the various aspects of the vision statement. And of course, in one way, the next generation of UUs is our children and youth. So we want to create conditions appropriate for their growth. And I'll say more about that in a minute. But first, I want to acknowledge that we have another form of next generation of UUs. You probably realize that the majority of UUs come from other traditions. About a quarter from mainline Christian churches, about 20% each from Baptist and Catholic traditions, around 10% from no tradition at all or from atheism, and bits and pieces of others. Creating conditions for the next generation of UUs will also mean welcoming the converts. Independent surveys tell us that more than 500 million Americans identify as UUs. And curiously, the count of members in our congregations is less than half of that. Unlike most other faith traditions, we are actually growing almost at the rate of the increase in population. Whether you talk about the reported numbers of congregation members or the surveyed numbers of self-identifying UUs, especially that survey number is definitely growing. But that means we're stable rather than declining, as almost all Christian denominations are. And because we have new people coming in from other traditions all the time, that means that the next generation of UUs also includes people we attract into the faith. And I'll have more to say about that next week with a piece of the vision we examine will be vibrant, open, and inspirational. So, back to the incubator for our children and youth to grow into these things. Lots of faith traditions focus on family and children. It's a pretty common thing. Our emphasis may not be unique, but it is particular. We don't view our children the same way that many more conservative groups do. We are not trying to create mini-me's. Rather, we value creativity and independence of mind more than we do obedience. We set boundaries and limits differently, encouraging children to explore and come to their own conclusions rather than telling them what they need to believe. Now, I know that some parents of adult children have been discouraged because their children have gone out and found religious connection in other traditions beside our own. I also suspect, though, that many of those self-identified UUs who are out there who are not currently in congregations actually grew up in one. So we have this reluctance to proselytize our children. And in the middle of the 20th century, I think that really showed itself. That there were lots of mixed feelings about growing our children into UUs. We wanted to be sure that they made their own choices, and this came naturally enough for people who had rejected the religions of their own upbringings. They didn't want to force feed their children religious doctrine, and in the process, many of them forgot to say, yes, we would really like you to stay and be a UU. Who here grew up as UU? There are a few. Does this seem familiar, this reluctance to invite our children into being UU? But part of the dilemma grows naturally out of our theological stance. Since the Radical Reformation, which is the wing of the Protestant tradition from which UUism arose, the informed adult decision to be part of a religious group has been essential. We don't baptize children into our tradition or in any direct, purposeful way coerce them to join. Rather, we insist that membership is open to adults. Each congregation defines what their membership is, so many UU churches do accept teenagers, especially those who've been through a coming-of-age class or similar process to examine where they are in relation to Unitarian Universalism. And whatever the particular definition, membership requires a conscious decision by someone mature enough to make such a commitment. That means we don't force our children to agree with this on religion. Or much of anything, actually. Our religious education is the antithesis of a catechism. Anyone here have to memorize a catechism when you were growing up? Okay. So, provide structured answers to a particular set of questions. Instead, we invite children's questions and even ask them questions to help them formulate their own thoughts. We value individual engagement and original ideas over obedience and memorization, even over order sometimes. Sometimes those priorities create tension. Children don't seem to behave in ways we remember from our own childhoods. We try to teach our children to think through situations, to understand other people's reactions, to make their own rational decisions about their behavior rather than laying out sets of formulaic rules. Now, sometimes some grown-ups don't think we're setting appropriate limits, and there's often tension around how we create safe space for our children to grow and develop. I once did some work with a coming-of-age group, 8th and 9th graders, who were making that transition from children in religious education to adult members of the congregation. And this particular group, the word that came up when we were out of earshot of the teens themselves, among the adults who worked with this group, was squirrely. One boy in particular was all over the place. It was like he couldn't sit in a chair without ending half in and half out of it, winding himself around it in ways that I would not have guessed the human body could go. Thoroughly antsy. Now, I've been a teacher, a special education teacher, in fact, and most educators would assume that by kindergarten, first grade at latest, kids could sit and attend, and that that's a requirement for them in order to learn. However, this 14-year-old didn't work that way. And after, I remember one particular teacher who watched a video about UU history. The one kid who consistently grasped the concepts, who had absorbed and even thought about the material, was this contortionist teenager. A reminder that standard pedagogy, keeping children orderly, may not be the most effective way always for them to learn. I'm a great admirer of Howard Gardner and his theory of multiple intelligences, that we are smart in different ways. Schools focus on linguistic and mathematical skills, not only in what they teach, but in how they teach. Well, many of us might learn better if approached through the form of intelligence that we have best developed. Some of us learn most comfortably through words, others through mathematical correspondences. Some learn best, though, through movement or rhythm and music. Others through spatial visualization. So awareness of various modalities, active engagement rather than passive reception, creates situations, conditions for all our children to learn more effectively. And these ideas matter as we envision our incubator. What do we teach? What ideas help create the conditions that nurture spiritual and moral development? We help our children and youth to learn something about what Unitarian Universalism is. Where we come from, historically, theologically. We also want them to know the breadth of the religions around the world, that many different people espouse many different faiths, and what some of the basics of those faiths are. We want them to recognize names like Buddha and Muhammad. And we'd like them to learn something about the religious cultures that surround them, the stories of Christianity and Judaism, people's ideas about God and Jesus. And that's the three pillars that we rotate through from year to year with our children: Unitarian Universalist Identity, World Religions, and Jewish and Christian Stories. They need these basics because, as I often tell parents, you don't want your children picking up religion on the streets. And they will if you don't teach them. So, one parent told me that she overheard her fourth grade daughter and friends talking about Lent. Some of them were giving up something for Lent, as many Christians do. And one girl didn't know anything about it and asked what Lent was. Turns out most of the Christian kids could not explain it. But our little UU girl knew exactly what it was, the 40 days that Christians spend spiritually preparing for Easter. She'd learned specific ideas, stories, and concepts that we teach, there are the explicit curricula. However, as you use, we don't think that's the only and maybe not even the most important aspect of religious education. In this morning's reading, William Ellery Channing, the 19th century Unitarian minister who first really expounded Unitarian principles and values, describes how we don't impose our religion on our children, but stir up their minds, challenge them to think through complex ideas, and in his words, awaken the soul. We want our children, and ourselves, not incidentally, to become people who seek truth, who discern and act morally in the world, who reject biases and prejudices, and embrace conscience and ideals. Now, how can such a set of goals be taught? Only through the implicit curriculum, by actively demonstrating the values of these facts, by inviting and affirming our children's perspectives, by including them and valuing their ideas. In short, I would describe UU religious education as more oriented toward process than toward content. For example, as Molly said, our teens right now are engaged in a curriculum phase. So each segment has a three-week process. First, they learn a bit about a particular religious tradition. And the curriculum doesn't say which traditions you must know about, though it makes some suggestions. But the class picks together what they're going to explore. And the process is what's key. So the first week, they learn a little bit about it. The next week, they visit a congregation that is from that tradition and worshiping in that way. And the third week, they come back and talk about their experience on that visit and compare and contrast it with the UU experience. So yes, they're learning something about other faiths, but more than that, they're learning that we respect and honor different religious traditions, that we, as UUs, share values with and diverge from different religious communities, and that all they learn that they can gather ideas and perspectives from different traditions and that their viewpoints as individual people matter. And that they matter to one another and that together they share these ideas, discuss, and come closer to the truth than any other single individual. So they're encouraged to think about what they observe, what they feel, and what they experience. And these are parts of the implicit curriculum. We teach them through how we are together. Value-based, the goals are those that Channing expounded on a couple of centuries ago. When I began my ministry, my first ministry in a brand new congregation, there was a group of children that sat on the front row, and they made me kind of uncomfortable, because week after week, they just sat there. Even as others around them stood for the opening hymn, they sat there and stared at me. I'm not sure whether it was a blank stare, or whether it was more confrontational, it felt like they were saying to me, what are you doing here? What are we doing here? There was nothing blatantly bad about what they were doing. They just didn't seem to be into it. But they were always watching. And then one week I noticed they were up and singing. Next thing I knew, even the four-year-old non-reader behind them was begging her mother to show her the right page on the hymnal. They had caught on to the ritual, the process. At first, they simply hadn't known what to do. And after some observation, they did. They got it. They were beginning to learn community, joining their voices with others. Implicit curriculum. We are one. Everything we do is teaching something, whether or not we intended. And there's also something in religious education we call the null curriculum. Explicit, implicit, and null curriculum, which is what we don't say, what we avoid talking about. And if we don't talk about stewardship of money, that sends a message that money doesn't matter. If we avoid any religious language that tells people that that doesn't matter. If we don't do social justice work, even if we say we believe in it, we communicate a message that it doesn't really matter, no matter what we say. So explicit, implicit, and null curriculum, we're always teaching something, not only to our children, but to ourselves. Another question, though. Are they always learning? Part of being an incubator requires that we have the right conditions. Abraham Maslow, the hierarchy of needs psychologist, said, we grow forward when the delights of growth and the anxieties of safety are greater than the anxieties of growth and the delights of safety. I love that. Let me say it again. We grow forward when the delights of growth and the anxieties of safety are greater than the anxieties of growth and the delights of safety. In other words, we need to be safe enough to be able to explore, but not too tied to our safety. At the same time, growth that pushes us into anxiety will not be effective, and safety that becomes overly comfortable can be a barrier. Somehow we have to balance safety and growth, challenge and comfort. One of the concepts useful to me in this is the idea of stages of faith. Our vision statement includes the phrase, fostering spiritual and ethical exploration tailored to age and stage. We're not going to teach kindergartners about existentialism. That's obvious. Stage may be a bit less clear. James Fowler, a professor of theology and human development, who died last year, developed a scheme of faith development stages parallel to Kohlberg's stages of moral development or Piaget's stages of cognitive development, if either of those sound familiar to you. First, what is faith in this context? And I'll take the definition from the front flap of Fowler's book. Faith is a person's way of leaning into and making sense of life. So faith need not have anything to do with God or with a formal religion, though it may. Rather, faith is a universal component of how one approaches one's life. What are the values that influence you most deeply? How do you decide your moral compass? What perspective helps you make sense of the big questions about mortality and morality? Fowler stages have long, multisyllabic, hyphenated names that are not easily accessible. Here's the general idea, though. In the earliest part of our lives, we don't really have a faith. But we do have significant experiences that shape later faith. The question is, do we feel safe and nurtured? Do we develop a sense of trust? So we're sending a very simple religious message even in our nursery care, assuring our tiniest ones that they are loved and cared. And as they get past the toddling stage, preschoolers learn through story and image. They haven't figured out the difference between truth and fiction and engage in magical thinking. So a young child might think her brother got sick because she wished he'd leave her alone. And when I think about all that little ones are figuring out about the world, why should that seem any less likely that when you turn on a switch, a light comes on? Or computers doing whatever it is they do when you swipe them or click them. At that early stage, we continue that sense of love and assurance and begin introducing ideas, often through story, but also through active engagement with the world to find out how it really does work. And we listen to the magical stories and accept that that's where children are at that age, appreciate the creativity, and don't worry too much about the misconceptions, because once they move into elementary school, children naturally develop a need to sort out truth from fiction. The first question they'll ask after you tell a story is, did that really happen? And they develop a strong sense of fairness. Have you ever heard a third grader assert, it's not fair? No one is a more dedicated freedom fighter. And everything is literal, though, because they have not yet developed the capacity for abstract thought. And so as children move into adolescence, they understand those abstractions and begin to integrate concepts like justice and peace. They also become concerned with conformity, particularly to peers. And faith becomes a matter of identifying with a particular tradition, a particular people, declaring, I am Catholic, or I am Buddhist, or I am you, in order to have a group to associate oneself with, building one's own identity from that of those they love and respect. And that's why that's the time for bar and bat mitzvahs and confirmation classes and UU circles coming of age programs. synthetic conventional. And one reason this is important is that actually many adults stay in that stage of faith development, not reaching out beyond the identity that has belonged to them. Stage four, individuative reflective. I'm told you the names are multisyllabic and difficult to access. That can actually come any time in adulthood when, for whatever reason, one stage three faith fails. Maybe your beliefs and doctrine quit adding up when you consider scientific reality. Maybe a loved one's death, or a scandal in the church, or some other specific experience triggers. Maybe it comes out of a slow series of unanswerable questions. At this stage, a person takes responsibility for their own beliefs and values. They become aware of conflicts in their own faith. They need not leave the faith that they're part of, but many people do at that point. It's a struggling stage, and it can be a very lonely place. UUs are more likely to get stuck in stage four than stage three, rejecting where they came from, but not finding a new solid foundation. Adult religious education needs to help people cope with the angst and the struggle for answers. Because there's more. In the next stage, conjunctive faith, some resolution is reached. A deeper understanding of metaphors and symbols of religion open new doors. And the individual at stage five sees the ways that religions harmonize with one another and appreciates the differences. And faith here becomes quite complex, multi-layered, and nuanced, but alive again in a new way, affirming of things rather than just rejecting and pushing away. So according to Fowler, people even take a step further into universalizing faith. Have you ever encountered someone whose deep sense of spirituality just seems to exude from them? I think of the Dalai Lama, whose presence radiates peace. At this stage, universal compassion and love rule, and people find themselves at peace with the world. It feels a lot more like a goal to me than a reality. So, we move through these stages when the delights of growth and the anxieties of safety are greater than the anxieties of growth and the delights of safety. Part of the incubator conditions we create include enough safety and enough delight in learning. So age and stage shape the opportunities and programs that we offer to people. And we accept people where they are and invite them to deepen their exploration of what it means to be human, what it means to be mortal, how to act in the world with integrity and compassion, how to understand the holy, how to make sense of the mystery. And the upshot is that youth leaders brought up in UU congregations amaze me. I can talk about specific individuals, but it's not just the exemplary and amazing individual kids. I love to watch how our youth can sort through setting guidelines for their own events and process what needs to happen for healing when someone has breached the expectations. Collectively, they inspire me. One of the wonderful things about being part of a religious community is watching children grow up and blossom in unexpected and sometimes even in expected ways. Which brings me to that promotion of intergenerational unity. How many places in your life do you have the chance to interact across generations? Many of our institutions break out according to age. Our families, of course, are multi-generational, but beyond that, it's hard to think of an institution that encourages crossing the generations. We can do that here. Religious groups may be one of the last places that really welcome and facilitate getting to know people of different ages than yourself. Here we can look to elders for their experience and historical perspective, to young adults for their idealism and the up-to-the-minute technical expertise, to adolescents for fresh approaches to issues that have become jaded and old for some of us, to children for the reminder to play and engage life through personal experience. We We can watch babies grow into children and teens and adults. We can welcome back young people who grew up and were shaped by this place and by these people. In other words, we can experience the vast gamut of life, observe its effects and nurture it in its many facets. Not a bad way to celebrate Valentine's Day. Our closing hymn is in the teal one. It's number 1051, Dar. And our choir is going to help us sing.
We had the benefit of rehearsing this earlier, and there are a lot of repeats in it. What happens when you get to a place where there is a wide bar and a skinny bar and two dots, that tells you to go back to a place where there is, where that thing just reversed. So in the beginning, for each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe, who are we? You know, for each child, it goes back to the top, very top of the thing and does it. Once you get through that first, the second time, you start at the bottom. We are our grandmother's prayer and so on, and you keep on going to page two, over to nearly the bottom of page three, where there are those two bars and two dots. Go back to the bottom of page 1050 of one. We are our grandmother's. Keep on going, and then on page, once you turn the page that second time, you don't have to turn it again. And you stay on that page, and I'll go to page four, and then down at the bottom of two sequences, each child is born, morning star rises, and the universe, who are we, for each child. Three times, fourth time. I'll hold up my fingers so you'll know where you are. Once you get to the fourth, get quick. Once you finish the fourth time. Got it? We're going to get it. We're going to get an introduction from the pianist, and then we will start going. I might say the beat of this thing is it's 6/8. What that means is there are two beats, two triplets. So it's 1-2-3, 2-2-3, 1-2-3, 2-2-3.
Don't worry about that.
All right.
Thank you.
powerfully than we. May we be bold in bringing to fruition the golden dreams of human kinship and justice. This we ask in the